Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 304, Ministry of Small Things. Monday, December 26th, 2022. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. Each time I record an episode, I post show notes, photographs, and links to things I talk about on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. You can also find quite a few links on the Linktree page that you can find in my profile on Instagram. Today's episode includes the following segments: the back porch, the front porch, so forth, and off the shelf. Hello, everyone, and welcome. It's Boxing Day. Happy Boxing Day. It's a bright, sunny, and bitter cold day here in Delaware Water Gap, Pennsylvania, where I'm coming to you pretty bright and early from the Yin Hu studio with some new podcasting equipment. Samuel gave me two gifts to help me create a more comfortable recording environment and help to deal with some of the street noise here where I'm recording in a studio space that faces the road. Samuel gave me a new microphone stand and an isolation booth that will hopefully be very helpful in minimizing distracting sounds. Right now, the distracting sounds are at a minimum because Route 611 right in front of the Castle Inn property is closed due to some rock slides that happened several weeks ago. This same stretch of road was closed in very early spring. It is difficult for the town and for transportation because a lot of people use that route instead of going on Route 80. However, when the road is closed, it becomes an excellent walking and biking path and a great place to see bald eagle action. And so we've been doing some of that. I posted, I think a few weeks ago on Instagram, some footage of a bald eagle trying to take off with a small animal carcass that it had been working on in the road. And we keep going back as much as we can to check out the bald eagles and just really take advantage of very little activity on that road to see some of that landscape and overlook the river as well. Thank you to my Ko-Fi supporters. I will be doing a quarterly drawing for a handmade gift, and anyone who makes a contribution on Ko-Fi, whether it be a one-time contribution or a monthly membership, will be entered into the drawing. The first prize I drew on December 21st, and the winner was able to receive it by Christmas. It was a collection of handmade quilted, sort of pseudo-quilted ornaments that I have been working on over the holiday season. And the recipient was Nancy, also known as Northern Flicker. Congratulations, Nancy, and thank you to all of my supporters. The next quarterly prize will be drawn on the spring equinox, March 20th, and I will be making a clothespin bag. This is one of my prized possessions. I sort of riffed a little on a pattern that I found in a Taproot issue. I'm making one as a Christmas gift right now, and it sort of put me in the mind to make yet another one and offer it up as a prize. A clothespin bag is great whether you hang your laundry on a line or indoors. It could also be used as a hanging pouch to store some other kind of item. I know people like little bags and pouches to put plastic bags, like to pick up after your dog, or just to have extra bags on hand. So I think this has quite a few potential uses, and I will make it look as adorable as possible. It's cotton on the exterior with some embroidery stitches. I'll have to figure out what I want to do for that. And then the interior is a cotton laminate so that you can easily wipe it or wash it out. You can find a link to my Ko-fi page on Instagram, on my website, and I'll be linking it also in this episode. The Hudson Valley Textile Project, which you've heard me talk about many times on this podcast, has an endeavor to expand the textile industry in the Northeast United States with a scouring facility. This has been many years in the planning, has already received a lot of support and funding, and there's just a little bit more to go. Gail Pirinello and Mary Jean Packer, who are on the board of the Hudson Valley Textile Project, recorded a podcast episode which gives more details and information about the project. I will certainly link to that episode on my website in case you're interested in learning more. But the gist of it is, when it comes down to local and regional production of fiber, a scouring facility is the essential starting point for getting that fiber from a farm to an end user. And there are fewer and fewer scouring facilities in the U.S., and so having one in the Northeast United States will serve a wide range of fiber production, because in New England, even in the Mid-Atlantic states, there's a lot of very small farming. It's not done on a large scale. And so what is needed is a scouring facility that can actually accommodate the 100 or 200 pounds of fiber that's going to come from a small farm and be able to scour it and get it ready for a mill. So there's been some movement on mills with smaller scale production, such as Batten Kill Fiber Mill. And if you have shopped at a festival or farm stand recently, you're probably familiar with some others. But before the fiber is really ready for a mill, it needs to be scoured. And so a regional scouring facility can really make a big difference. And the groundwork has been laid out and the planning for a facility has been done. What is needed now is just some additional funds to really get this off the ground. Just before recording this episode, I made a financial contribution to this GoFundMe. And I encourage you, whether it's $5 or $500, if you find yourself with the capacity at the end of 2022 to make a contribution to a worthy cause, you consider this one. I'll be putting in abundant links, and I'll also be sharing this on my social media feed, because I know it is extremely important. It's something that Carol and Mary Jean have been talking about. ever since I have known them and since I started to bring people to the area to enjoy the farms and the fiber and to learn about local and regional production, they've been talking about the need for something like this. So it would be very exciting to be a part of this endeavor and this big, you know, shift in making jobs available, making things more local, requiring less fuel to truck things around, getting faster turnaround for products, which is really important to farmers. So I encourage you to think about it, to contribute if you can. If you can't, sharing this information to others is a great way to make a contribution, because the more people who know about it, the sooner that this GoFundMe goal can be reached. Right now, it's about halfway there. They put up a GoFundMe goal of about $15,000, and it is currently over $7,000. Thanks in advance for your consideration for this project and for helping out if you can. The back porch. In episode 301, when I talked about my knitting, I mentioned that I was making the Wedgwood scarf for Samuel. It's a design by Stephen West, and that I was well on my way and I really couldn't foresee anything interfering with my progress after I had started it several times and made some adjustments. Yes, that is what I said. I was about halfway through the scarf, knitting on it in a short break, or I was waiting or something in my car with abundant winter sunlight, when I noticed way back in the first wedge, I had just unintentionally, instead of doing that wedge in all stockinette, there was a garter ridge right in the middle of the wedge. And all the wedges were supposed to be stockinette stitch, and the rows in between them were supposed to be garter stitch. So I ripped it back pretty much all the way to the beginning after being halfway through. And in looking at that one very irritating row of garter, I decided that maybe doing the entire scarf in garter stitch is the way that I should go. Because one of the things I felt apprehensive about was that this lace weight cashmere yarn that I purchased from Springtide Farm at Rhinebeck was extremely delicate, and garter stitch is like squishier and more substantial. It's also faster than purling long rows. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe the big message here is just that I should be doing the whole thing in garter stitch. So I did. When I started over with the wedges in this scarf, I just knit the entire thing. The scarf features intarsia and short rows and is a very attractive design. If you're looking for something that would work well with yarn scraps or some of those minis, take a look at Wedgwood. I think it has, you know, it's sort of modeled on a man, and I think it can have a very masculine look to it, but I think it's sort of the ultimate in unisex design, as many of Stephen West's patterns are. And you could really get playful with this and use up a lot of scraps. After beginning this scarf again, and I don't even know how many times I restarted this, maybe now five, it was just a bit of a slog because I was just sort of done with working on it, and yet I had so much knitting to do on US 1.5 needles with lace weight yarn. It was a lot of knitting. So eventually I did complete the knitting, and I was very fortunate to get some wooden toggle buttons from my friend Dee, who has just a wonderful stash of everything fiber and textile related. And I added the buttons and some I-cord loops, and Samuel really likes the scarf. He hasn't worn it yet. Of course, he just received it yesterday. But I think it does look very handsome on him. He didn't remark at all that it seemed thin or flimsy, which was my concern. And I think I have it fashioned in a way that it won't be fiddly and it will just stay in place. In retrospect, I wish that I had purchased some very inexpensive lace weight or fingering weight yarn in similar colors to what I had in the cashmere and just held that double throughout the knitting to make a more dense and beefier scarf. In all the times that I restarted it, I don't know why that didn't occur to me, but it just seems so obvious now. You have that beautiful cashmere and it's lovely. And if you just had another strand to make it like a fingering or a sport weight, it would be such a much better object. But, you know, live and learn, because sometimes it just takes a long time to understand these things about knitting so that you can approach it with all of that collected wisdom and just make a better start at a project. So, lesson learned, actually a lot of lessons. For such a simple project, it ended up being quite challenging. And unfortunately, I did not use all the yarn. So I still have some really odd amounts of this very expensive yarn. I'll have to think about how to maybe work them into a future project. While I was working on Samuel's scarf, I was also planning all along to knit a small toy project called Frog by Claire Garland. I did this in collaboration with Mary Beth, who was also knitting these small toys for her granddaughters, and planned to give the frog to Briar as a Christmas gift, along with a beautiful hardbound copy of Frog and Toad. And we will not see Briar until after Christmas, so I knew I had plenty of time and I wasn't in a rush. I really enjoyed knitting the body of Claire Garland's frog pattern. It's an extremely popular pattern. It's a free pattern. And it results in a very shapely frog, very expressive. Easy to put the body of this frog together. And then I had purchased my first ever safety eyes for the frog, and it was very easy to place these safety eyes on the knitted item. It was pretty clear where they went and where it would look best, and, you know, stitch up the body. The directions for the legs on this frog I found extremely frustrating and difficult to get right and be satisfied with the look of them. And I didn't have enough yarn to really keep fussing with it. So what I ended up doing was starting over and knitting the frog again with some yarn that I had, the green in abundance. And I held it double. So this was a sport weight yarn that I held double on US 3 needles for the body of the frog, because I wanted it to be really dense with no stuffing poking through. And then for the breast or the belly of the frog, I used Slate Bell yarn that I have just purchased from Hope Horn at her wool school. This is a local yarn with a lot of fuzziness to it, which is what was called for in the pattern. And so I was really pleased with that. And then when I started this frog over for the legs, instead of knitting them in I-cord, I picked up stitches in the way I've learned with some of Susan B. Anderson's knitted toys. I picked up right from the body and joined to knit in the round and knit a tube rather than an I-cord. I also stuffed the upper parts of each limb with a little bit of wool to give it that muscular look. And I took a long time fiddling with twist ties to create bendy arms and legs so that this frog could be posed. And with that comes, you know, covering everything so you can't see it peeking through, and also so that no wires or anything poke through. So the arms and legs took a considerable amount of time. I did not enjoy the claw-like toes in Claire Garland's pattern. So I took a look at the frog and toad pattern. I did not purchase it, but I examined the photographs quite a bit and decided to make more of like flipper feet for the frog in the way that it looks in that pattern. I mean, I don't know what the directions are, but I was just taking a look and imitating it with some ribbed stitching for the webbed feet and hands, paws of the frog. And I really liked that look. I found it a lot less fiddly than the pattern that I was using from Claire Garland. So it was kind of like a hodgepodge of different things. Then after completing the frog, I really wanted to give him a little outfit. So I purchased Claire Garland's sweater pattern. I thought that it was knit in the round, but then realized the directions were for knitting it flat, which resulted in so many ends to weave in. But then once I had gone through all that work of knitting the striped little, oh, it's so cute, this striped cardigan flat, I decided to keep it as a cardigan and not seam it up the back. So it looks like a little striped jacket. It's much easier for a child, I think, to get it on and off the frog than if it had been a pullover. And I really love the look of it. So yesterday, Samuel and I had a bunch of fun posing this frog in all different poses. And then we took a little banjo ornament off the tree and posed it with that. And it's just really super fun. It's a nice size. I would say it's about 8 or 9 inches from nose to toe, and a lot of fun to pose and play with. My hope is that Briar really enjoys this frog. Who knows? There could be the distraction of lots of other gifts and presents, so we'll see, but I think it's a really nice keepsake, and I am very pleased with how it came out. Toys are so deceptive because they're small and it seems like they will be quick, but I often find knitting them at a tight gauge quite a bit of stress on my hands and even my neck and shoulders a little bit. And then to get their expressions right and to get all of that finishing done just so, it always takes more time than I anticipated. So I'm glad to be done. It's like, you know, wipe the brow and move on. And just like the last time, I'll say, oh, no more toys for a while. Some other tiny things I've been knitting have been a series of tiny trees this pattern for a tiny tree with a snowy top and some little sparkly beads was something I first saw on PMC Freeburn's Instagram page, and I just thought it was so charming. So I've sort of merged that pattern, which I will link in my show notes, with a concept that I used several years ago to make a tree with a ribbed band around the base that you put over a wine cork. So I kind of merged the two patterns and used up a lot of little bits of scrap yarn, also some hand spun, and made a whole little forest of trees to go with the ceramic village that I purchased several years ago from the Woolly Thistle. It's so beautiful and charming with a strand of lights, and I just keep adding little details to this village. It sits right on my dining room table, and it's something that I enjoy throughout the holiday season. I've also been knitting some teeny tiny gnomes with the pattern No Fun Like Gnome Fun, which if you're going to buy one gnome pattern, I recommend this one because you can knit several different styles of gnomes in several weights of yarn. The very tiniest of them works up super quick and is a great gift, a stocking stuffer, something you can hang, you know, like a little ornament on a larger gift. They're just really, really great and really fun to make. So those have become sort of part of my traditional holiday season that I'll always get some yarn out to work up a few gnomes, and that's a lot. The front porch. Now that Christmas obligation knitting is coming to a close, I can turn my attention to some projects that I've been wanting to work on. One is the winter light mittens. I've mentioned them already in a previous episode, and I have really beautiful, hefty yarn to use for those and knit up something really warm and cozy for the winter. I've also begun a pair of fingering weight mittens with Joanna of Knitspin Farm's Hoarfrost colorway. This was given to me by Emily of Fibertown, and she used part of it on some socks and gave me the remainder. I think this winter, instead of doing my usual sock knitting, I'll do some mitten knitting and use up some of my sock yarn with mittens, trying to internalize a mitten pattern the same way I've internalized my sock knitting. I've been working with a tin can knits pattern, but because I'm working at a US size 0 gauge, I want a nice dense gauge on these mittens, I've had to go beyond even the largest size that's recommended there. And I'll just be maybe printing out a copy and altering the numbers as I go, trying to work out something that will do well for a mitten at a very fine gauge, and then work up maybe a couple different pairs. I've also been looking through patterns for sweaters, wraps, and larger garment items so that I can cast on a bigger project, but I haven't really been able to settle on anything yet. I've looked at quite a few different things. I have some absolutely gorgeous yarn in stash, sweater quantities of really nice stuff. I just haven't felt like I've hit upon the perfect thing that will get a lot of wear. and I'm still on the lookout. So if you see something you think might be interesting, send it my way for consideration. Sometimes I keep looking, you know, at the same things over and over again, and maybe I need to be shaken up a little bit with some things that haven't come into my radar recently. Since speaking to you last, I did complete the Maynard dress designed by LB Textiles. This is a zero-waste dress design. So the entire pattern lays on top of a folded piece of fabric, and then you use up every single little bit for your pattern pieces. There is no waste. Essential to making a dress like this is to make sure that your fabric is folded on the grain line. Somehow, either I had a warped piece of fabric, something that was not true, which is possible, but more likely is that I was sloppy in how I folded the fabric and cut the dress. And so even though the dress design is asymmetrical, the entire thing is wonky because it's sort of skewed in a lot of places. And it took a long time for me to make the dress because I was constantly trying to correct for this not quite straight fabric. So I'm not sure about this dress. I'm not sure if I'm dissatisfied with it because of the way that I cut it, or I will never be satisfied with it because of the way the pattern works. It's difficult to know. I used a black linen fabric, very plain. Essential to making this dress is that you have a fabric that doesn't have an obvious right side and wrong side, because you see the wrong side of the fabric quite frequently in the design. So you don't want it to be obvious that you're looking at the back side of printed fabric, for example. So a linen or some kind of blend, you know, something that it's so difficult to tell, you really need to mark the right and wrong sides of every single pattern piece. That would be ideal for this pattern. I think I chose the correct size. There doesn't seem to be a sizing problem. The fit is a little bit awkward and unusual. That's partly the asymmetry, probably partly my skewed cutting. I like the length of it. I like the pockets and the sort of long and flowy aspect of it. I've been wearing it, even though I'm not 100% satisfied, because I believe in making something and wearing it if at all possible. And the most interesting way I've found to wear it is to put a unitard on under the dress and sort of drape that around with a belt, like, I don't know, like a high fashioned robe kind of thing. I'll put a picture in the show notes. I wore it to work one day and a colleague took a picture. I think having the unitard underneath the dress prevents me from feeling so self-conscious about the way that the armholes are shaped and just the, you know, sort of the sliding and the wrap style of the dress, the shifting that can occur. And so the unitard just gives nice coverage, and it also makes it a little bit warmer for wearing a linen garment in cold weather. I don't currently have another piece of fabric that would be suitable for trying this dress again. If I did, I might just go immediately into trying another version. and maybe using that tactic, I've never done it, but I know what it is, to pull a thread and then make sure that you're folding your fabric on the grain line. I might try that. I might also just keep in mind this dress, and if I come across a piece of discount fabric or something that would be suitable, then I might pick up some more fabric to try the dress again. So I guess in retrospect, maybe I do like the design enough to try it again. I think it is best suited for someone who is 5'6 or taller and someone who likes a bit of drape and sort of like an open neckline, open collar type thing. If you like a garment that's sort of very fixed and secure, this is not your garment because there's kind of like a lot of slipping and adjusting to it. Once again, that is the Maynard dress from LB Textiles. This week, while I have a week break from work, I would really like to get my hands busy with an alphabet quilting project. I have purchased, downloaded, and printed the All Well alphabet. I guess it's like a bit of a zine that has all of the instructions for using quilting techniques to make letters. And this idea of combining text and textiles is very interesting to me. And I think I would like to start out by making a sign for Yinhu Studios. So that's not too many letters, very simple and straightforward, very clear end result, something that I could work on doing. So I just need to pick out some fabric for that because I don't have anything that would really be suitable for this project. And then thinking about the colors that I want to do. Eventually, I would like to extend this into a line of poetry. That's one of the things that she suggests in this zine. I just haven't settled on what that might be yet. But as I work my way through the 100 Days Project, reading at least one poem every day, I am gathering some possibilities for that. Speaking of the 100 Day Project, it is time for Off the Shelf when I traditionally share some poetry with you. Since recording episode 301, I have recorded and uploaded two additional episodes, which are essentially poetry readings of 10 poems each. I'm reading a poem a day from Black Friday, which was Friday, November 26th, all the way through the beginning of March. And thanks to my Ko-Fi supporters, I am on occasion recording and uploading a poetry reading, a selection. Today, I want to share two things that I've read over the past 10 days that aren't exactly poems, they're more about poetry and the reading and writing of poetry. I pull a book off my shelf in the morning in the dark, and I thought that I had kind of weeded prose books out of that section of my shelf, but I didn't. And one morning I ended up downstairs with my coffee and this book by Tony Hoagland called Real Sophistication, which is essays on poetry and craft. So I didn't want to go back upstairs and return this book and get another one. I just started reading. And then a few days later, I pulled another book by Mark Doty called Still Life with Oysters and Lemon, which also contains some writing and some thoughts about the topic of poetry. So I thought I would combine those two and share a little bit of that with you today as a way to close this episode. So from Tony Hoagland, this is a chapter late in the book called Thingitude and Causality in Praise of Materialism. It begins with an excerpt from Lou Welch. Step out onto the planet. Draw a circle 100 feet round. Inside the circle are 300 things nobody understands and maybe nobody's ever really seen. How many can you find? In New York, I get into an empty hotel elevator and smell cigarette smoke. Someone has been breaking the rules. Maybe tapping the ashes into the palm of his hand or catching them in the sleeve of the half-empty pack, trying to leave no evidence. Maybe it was the Jamaican night clerk trying to stay awake at 5 a.m. or the short, leathery Irish nun I passed on the fourth floor. And someone else has left a ghost in this small room, a faint trace of lilac perfume. Those other lives, their little stories. And was the person wearing perfume the same as the one who smoked? To stand alone in the midday quiet on the frayed flowered carpet of the hotel elevator, descending like a spider on its black cable, is like a sweet secret I am finally in on. It's not that I shunned the material world when I was younger. Rather, I hardly noticed it. The fierce bubbling of anxiety and desire tended to obstruct my view of the environment. When I was 18, I thought the world was what you stood on while you were having your identity crisis. I thought it was the place examples came from. I churned up plenty of experience, like a dirt bike charging up a muddy slope, but none of it seemed to stick. Finding out that the physical world was not a theory or a feeling was quite a shock for me. In the salons of aesthetic theory, one long-standing postulate claims that postmodern conditions elicit and require radical artistic forms. When T.S. Eliot says, "These fragments I have shored against my ruins," one way we understand it is fragmented self plus fragmented world equals fragmented poem. In order to be legitimate and adequate, the assumption goes, modernist poetry should incorporate confusion into its means or its ends. Largely, I subscribe to this standardized description of modern experience. My personal sense of self is that of barely manageable wreckage. Likewise, the contemporary civilized world feels to me like a wild, disparate, disorganized cascade of data, merchandise, noise, stimuli, selves, quite horrible in its volume, if not in its particulars. Yet, it is precisely my own private, internalized postmodernity, my short attention span, my rootless life, my neural disarray, my ruins and fragments that has led me, increasingly, to value the material world in poems. As a younger reader, I loved poems that bent and disassociated this world that only pretended to be sensible and neat. I hated the poetics of realism because of the ways it seemed to confine and oppress possibility. Having no distance from immediate experience, I only desired to escape it. Now, I crave information and arrangement. I like to read nonfiction prose, and I love poems that locate, coordinate, and subordinate, that build up a compound picture of the world. These poetic properties of attention, proportion, and relationality I have come to think of as thingitude and causality. Perhaps this is a matter of taste or the encroaching conservatism of age. But I don't entirely believe that my shift in preference is just personal. I think it has been a matter of instinct, the way a body senses a vitamin deficiency and craves tomato or cauliflower. The environment, by which I mean life in a first world culture at the start of the 21st century, is so corrupted, distorted, so informationally dense, and so disconnected, it elicits a longing for perspective. When I look around me, I see a whole population of young poets who also seem disconnected, who are operating in the realm of conceptual excitement and linguistic fabrication, their flags planted in the seemingly endless fertility of self, poetical theory, and manic invention. To them, I would advocate more thingitude and causality. And then Tony Hoagland goes on to examine a few different poems and explain how the author achieves this focus, this groundedness in material things. Really enjoyed reading that. And then, like I said, a few days later, I pulled off the shelf Still Life with Oysters and Lemon by Mark Doty, which is a long essay on a painting. And the painting is printed on the back cover of the book. It's a Dutch still life, as you might imagine, with oysters and a lemon. And Mark Doty gets at some of the same points and the same line of argument in his book. So I just want to read a bit of it to you to give you an idea. It's a simple painting, really, Still Life with Oysters and Lemon, by one Jan Davids de Heem, painted in Antwerp some 350 years ago and displayed today, after who knows what places it has been, in a glass case at the Metropolitan, lying flat so that one bends and looks down into its bronzy autumnal atmosphere. Half-filled Romer, an old Dutch drinking glass with a knobby base, with an amber inch of wine, dewy grapes, curl of a lemon peel, shimmery, barely solid bodies of oysters shucked in order to allow their flesh to receive every ministration of light. It is an atmosphere. The light lovingly delineating these things is warm, a little fogged, encompassing, tender, ambient. As if added to the fragrance evoked by the sharp pulp of the lemon and the acidic wine and the salty marsh scent of the oysters were some fragrance the light itself carried. Simple, and yet so firm in its assertions, I'll try to name them. That this is the matrix in which we are held, the generous light binding together the fragrant and flavorful productions of vineyard, marsh, and orchard. Where has that lemon come from? The Levant? That the pleasures of what can be tasted and smelled are to be represented, framed, set apart. That pleasure is to be honored. That the world is a dialogue between the degrees of transparency, the globes of the grapes, the wine in the glass, equally penetrated by light, but ever so slightly less clear than the vessel itself. Degrees of reflectivity. That the world of reflection implicates us as well. There, isn't that the faintest image of the painter in the base of the glass, tilted, distorted, lost in the contemplation of his little realm? Looking through things as well, through what he's made of them, toward us. That there can never be too much of reality. That the attempt to draw nearer to it, which will not fail entirely, as it will give us not the fact of the lemons and oysters, but this, which is its own fact, its own brave essay towards what is. That description is an inexact, loving art and a reflexive one. When we describe the world, we come closer to saying what we are. And something else, of course, there's always more deep in art's pockets, further down in the chiaroscuro on which these foodstuffs rest. Everything here has been transformed into feeling as if by looking very hard at an object, it suddenly comes that much closer to some realm where it isn't a thing at all, but something just on the edge of dissolving. Into what? Tears, gladness. You've felt like this before, haven't you? Taken far inside. Held. Maybe that's what the darkness behind these things, that warm brown ground is, the dark space within an embrace. And intimacy, says the phenomenologist Gaston Bachelard, is the highest value. Thanks for listening. I so appreciate your support and your enthusiasm for the podcast and look forward to putting out new episodes for you in the new year. I wish you all the blessings of the season and hope that you find time this week for the crafting you enjoy. Take care.